On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arianna Huffington was the tall, skinny Greek kid who talked her way into Cambridge University and then onto the American media stage. She's married rich, written up a storm, taken on television, run against Schwarzenegger for governor in California, and along the way made a noisy migration from the political right to the political left. Now, Arianna Huffington is the progressive publisher of the Huffington Post, one of the hottest political intersections and blogger battlegrounds on the web. She's watching the left and the right, and she's out with a new book on fearlessness in a time of fear. Joining me now from New York is Arianna Huffington. She came to America 26 years ago. Arianna Stassinopoulos married Republican Michael Huffington in 1986, talked her way into the heart of the American political conversation. He ran for the Senate and lost. They divorced. She ran for California governor against Arnold Schwarzenegger. Her news and commentary website, Huffington Post, has boomed into a major online media venue. She's author of 11 books. Her latest is On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life. Arianna Huffington, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you as well.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Arianna.
And Jack,
hi, Jack.
Jack, what was that Icarus story we were talking about a couple years ago with Arianna now? The most upwardly mobile Greek since Icarus, as I recall. That's great.
I hope I'll have a better ending.
Well, you never know. It's a big sun. It's nuclear, we're told. Arianna Huffington, fear, you're writing about it, and fearlessness. Who's most captive of fear these days?
Well, what prompted me to want to write the book was really the fact that I'm the mom of two teenage daughters, and I suddenly saw them full of fears. I saw my bald 7- and 8-year-olds being transformed into these fear-filled teenagers. Am I smart enough? Am I pretty enough? Am I going to be liked? All those questions that I had to deal with, our generation had to deal with, and I thought and hoped that my children wouldn't have to deal with in the same way, reared their ugly head. And at the same time, as you said in the introduction, I've been writing every day about fear and fear-mongering, and there are the legitimate fears, and then there are all the ways in which fear is being used to manipulate an electorate. So I wanted to write a book in which I'm hoping to start a kind of an epidemic of fearlessness, because in the same way that fear is contagious, fearlessness is contagious. And I really believe that we can all become like positive carriers of fearlessness. And by that, I don't mean an absence of fear. I mean the mastery of fear. I mean taking steps towards where we want to go, towards changing our lives in the direction we want to change them, even when we are afraid.
It sounds like a theme that will have you out on the speaking circuit for a long time, raking in those big speakers' bucks, Arianna. But where do you see it going in terms of American politics? I mean, there's fear in lots of directions here. There's fear on the right, there's fear on the left, there's fear in the center. I mean, are the wings of American politics equally captives of fear?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that when we are more fearless in our personal lives, we are going to be more fearless in our political lives, both as citizens, both in terms of being able to see through the fog of fear and make rational decisions when we vote, and also as political leaders, because one of the major problems at the moment in our country is that our politicians are in the grip of fear, especially politicians on the Democratic side of the aisle. I mean, let's just take a look down memory lane. If Democratic leaders had not been afraid of losing the 2002 election, if they had voted against the authorization to go to war in Iraq, we would not be at war now. I mean, they became enablers out of fear. And they are continuing to be enablers out of fear because they are buying into the fear-mongering about, quote-unquote, cutting and running and not standing up for what they know is right. We've known for a long time that there is no victory possible in Iraq. We have every day more news about how disastrous, for our own safety, what we're doing in Iraq is. And yet, Democratic leaders are not, with the exception of Jack Murtha and a few others, speaking unequivocally and powerfully about it. I mean, John Kerry has found his voice now, but it's kind of late. given the equivocation of the 2004 election. And I trace it all back to fear.
So who's the prisoner? Who are prisoners of fear and who are users of fear? Or can you be both at the same time?
No, I think there's no question that the people who are manipulating fear are obviously those making strategy for the Republican Party. You know, Karl Rove, chief among them. They've seen this is their only card left at the moment. It's incredibly effective because fear is a very powerful emotion. But so is fearlessness. And as I've been going around the country, I really see how we can spread that epidemic of fearlessness because we can tap into those reserves that we all have. And it's almost like a muscle, too. The more we use it, the more it grows. I mean, every time we make a decision about our own lives, in our own personal relationships, at work, in parenting, that is based on fearlessness rather than fear, despite our fears, we get closer to a fearless place that is easier and more natural to us as we move on with our lives.
Jack Beatty, the world is a big and scary place very often, always has been in a lot of ways. Do you see fear looming that much larger? Are we still in the grips of it, a kind of post-9/11, I don't know, post-modernist fear?
I don't myself. I understand that it's, you know, it's a political button and that the Republicans are using it and the Democrats in their own way are using it. But I don't really see it. What I sense instead is maybe a subtler thing, insecurity, which goes to economics as well. I think that's epidemic. I think people are just terribly anxious about their status in this economy, that in some fundamental way things are turning against the average person. A recent poll showed that more Americans now think their children will be worse off than they were economically. That may be unprecedented. That's what I see, this economic insecurity that bleeds off into a wider insecurity again about terrorism and so on. But I think at the root, it's this feeling that for the middle class, this is a perilous time.
Okay, maybe we're getting to the nub of it here. We've got 6 weeks to the midterm elections from today. Jack Beatty points to the economy. Arianna Huffington, you've just written very recently, you said it's not the economy, stupid. So how do you think the Democrats are doing on the path to the midterm elections? Are they ringing the right bells here? Where do you see the electorate's bigger likely response around these issues of economic insecurity or real fear?
Unquestionably real fear. Every poll puts Iraq as the defining issue of this election. And I'm amazed that Democrats are not hearing it. And the reason is that we all operate, first of all, on survival. So if a politician cannot clear the threshold of keeping us safer, no matter how great our economic insecurities are, and they are, Jack is absolutely right about that, this is not going to be what we're going to vote in November. And that's what Democrats need to recognize. And especially after the news this weekend that our own spy agencies are telling us that the war in Iraq is making us less safe. I mean, if I were a Democrat running for office, I would not be talking about anything else at the moment because that's the key. I mean, remember, security moms, as they were called, gave the election to George Bush in 2004. They abandoned John Kerry in larger numbers than expected, and that made the margin of victory for George Bush. So that is really the key, especially since the evidence is so overwhelming that their fog of fear and their pretense that they're going to keep us safer is purely delusional. Why not use that to convince the American public to not vote their fears, but to vote basically their hopes.
Not to succumb to our lizard brains, you write. There you sit in the midst of a storm of largely left-leaning commentary at Huffington Post. 6 weeks to go. Do you see the Democrats? Do you see the left plank of this country pulling it together? Do you see a majority coming in either house of Congress?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't buy into this left-right view of looking at American politics through that left-right lens at all times. I really believe it is so obsolete. I mean, look at the war in Iraq. I mean, some of the most profound and interesting and brave responses against the war have come from the right, whether it's Bill Buckley on the intellectual level or Congressman Walter Jones from North Carolina on the political level.
Or a whole string of generals in Congress.
Or a whole string of generals. Or even Senator Chuck Hagel constantly challenging what we're doing in Iraq. And yet the media continue to look at it as a left-right issue, as though to be against the war in Iraq, to want to bring our troops home, is somehow left-wing.
Okay, call it GOP Democrats, Republican Democrats. Do you see the Democrats then, if the GOP's done as bad a job as you say, do you see them on track to take back Washington?
Unfortunately, I don't. No, I don't see them on track to take back Washington because they're still governed by fear. They're still governed by fear of saying the wrong thing, of being kind of given that framing of the Republicans, of cutting and running, of being unpatriotic, of not supporting our troops. And they are not really, in a fearless way, standing up and explaining to the American people in ways that would be so clear to them that being in Iraq at the moment, sacrificing our troops, sacrificing our resources is actually making us less safe.
Arianna, I'd like to listen back for a minute here, if we may, to Bill Clinton and Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. Arianna, I assume you've caught this by now.
Yes, and I wrote about it.
Yeah, we saw a little of that in Jack as well. Let's listen to Bill going after Chris Wallace on the issue of, Chris had asked, why didn't you do more to put bin Laden and al-Qaeda out of business when you were president?
So you did Fox's bidding on this show. You did your nice little conservative hit job on me.
Well,
what I want to know
is...
Wait a minute, sir. I'm asking a question. You don't think that's a legitimate question? No, it was a perfectly legitimate question, but I want to know how many people in the Bush administration you asked this question of. I want to know how many people in the Bush administration you asked, why didn't you do anything about the coal? I want to know how many people you asked, why did you fire Dick Clark? I want to know how many people you asked
about
this.
Did you ever watch Fox News Sunday, sir?
I don't believe you asked them that.
We asked plenty of questions.
You didn't ask that, did you? Tell
about
the
U.S.
Chris.
Coal?
Tell the truth.
With Iraq and Afghanistan, there's plenty of stuff to ask.
Did you ever ask that? You set this meeting up because you're going to get a lot of criticism from your viewers because Rupert Murdoch's supporting my work on climate change. And you came here under false pretenses and said that you'd spend half the time talking about, you said you'd spend half the time talking about what we did out there to raise $7 billion plus in 3 days from 215 different commitments. And you don't care.
Bill Clinton with Chris Wallace. Arianna Huffington, is that fearlessness?
Yes, and feistiness. And I much prefer the Bill Clinton that we just heard than the Bill Clinton of the last few years, who's been desperately trying to be adopted by George Bush Sr. and be liked by everybody, and inviting Laura Bush to give the keynote at the Global Initiative, and basically trying to blur the differences between the two very different ways of running this country and especially keeping this country safe, the Republican and the Democratic. It was a very, very great surprise to see that Bill Clinton still has the ability to take on those whom he's been trying to court in the last few years.
In your phrase, in your second language here, no less, his bipartisan love-in has resulted in jack squat, the phrase of Arianna Huffington. So there's been a lot of speculation about whether, you know, Bill Clinton was doing this deliberately as a kind of a rallying performance to the Democratic millions, or whether he was just genuinely teed off in the moment there. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think for a second he was doing it deliberately. I mean, you can hear the anger in the voice. And, you know, we are all so used to prepackaged politicians who just give us their pre-approved sound bites and are increasingly becoming more processed than Velveeta that it's a relief to just hear somebody getting angry and expressing it. The American public, trust me, likes that. I mean, that's part of what they like about George Bush, that he appears authentic. So let's just have more of that. Let's just have some real debate going on into 06 and not this kind of prepackaged sound bites that we've all gotten so tired of.
06 and on into 08. What about the other half of the Clinton duo? You're saying recently about Hillary Clinton, you're asked if she's afraid of anything. You said she's clearly frightened of losing. You can smell the fear on her. It wafts around her like a cheap perfume. That bad?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton's main causes in the last few years, again, including co-sponsoring a bill for flag burning, you know, against flag burning. What is that except pandering? Why is her position on Iraq so tragically equivocating, triangulating, calculating? She's a brilliant woman. She's disciplined. Can we just have a little more fearlessness? Because that's what the country needs. Can't we just hear her talk from her conviction, no matter what happens? And trust me, she will do better as a result, because that equivocation is so transparent. And the American public, especially at a time of war, is really turned off by it.
Mark's calling from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
We're good. What do you see?
I am a regular reader of the Huffington Post, and Ariane, I think you do a great job, and in particular because it's a great resource for facts. I think that the fear that we're seeing is a fear of fact, and it's a wonderful tool that the administration and the right wing has used to divert people from facing the real issues. And let me give you a graphic example of how this plays
out. Okay.
If you look at Newsweek this week, Newsweek is running, they run editions all over the world. They have an edition that appears in every market except the United States, the cover of which is a giant picture of an Afghan Taliban fighter with an RPG, and the headline is Losing the War in Afghanistan.
Okay.
If you look at the American edition, you see a fluffy piece on Annie Leibovitz, great photographer, but the point is that they're afraid that the American public won't buy their magazine if they see a cover that blares that we're losing the war in Afghanistan. That there is a fear in this country of confronting the facts. The NIE that has been buried for 6 months is an example of that.
This is the new intelligence report saying Iraq has generated more terrorism than it's batted back.
The significance of that report is not only that it says whatever Americans in general feel and understand to be the truth, but that report was generated, it was finished 6 months ago, it was begun a year before that, and since that report was finalized in April, you've had President Bush and Vice President Cheney going around saying exactly the opposite. Because they're afraid that if Americans have the facts, they will lose big time in this election. And by the way, Mr. Beattie, I think you do a great job generally, but I think you're wrong on this. I think you've got to pick your head up and look at the bigger picture. This is a concerted effort to divorce people from reality. It's why global warming has been denied. It's why you have a war on science generally. If facts are negotiable, then you can instill fear in people.
So. You've got an interesting perspective there, a fascinating one, Mark. Let us pick it up, Ariana. I'll come to you as well, Jack. But, Ariana, what about this notion that somehow the American public itself has been turned fearful? It's afraid of reality.
I couldn't agree with Mark more. Thank you so much, Mark. You should blog about it on the Huffington Post. I really feel that Mark sees exactly what is going on, this battle against reality, this battle against facts, whether it's in terms of what's happening in Iraq. I mean, you had the Vice President of the United States tell us that the insurgency was in its death throes just before everything exploded in Iraq, not to mention all the previous delusional statements and the subsequent ones. So it's time that the media hold them accountable, and that we keep shedding a light on those delusional statements until the public really wakes up to what's going on. But I really believe...
But Mark's saying that the public doesn't want to wake up. They don't want the Newsweek cover with the RPG holding Talibani on the front.
You know, that's what leadership is about. Leadership is about creating a new consensus. Leadership is about looking around the corner, seeing where the dangers are, and honestly talking to the American people. I mean, you could say the public didn't want slavery abolished. You know, Lincoln went on anyway. And that is, at the moment, you know, our leaders have become just followers of opinion polls. And right now, Tom, actually the opinion polls show that the public is ahead of the leaders when it comes to Iraq and when it comes to issues of our national security. I mean, the numbers have turned on the president, but the Democrats have not done a good job at clearly and unequivocally producing an alternative strategy in the war of terror.
Jack, do you see an American fear of facts with Iraq at the center?
I think Mark is right on. We were actually talking about this in our editorial meeting the other day with reference to the national intelligence estimate. A few years ago, in a very striking piece in the New York Times magazine, someone from, I forget who it was, but a White House political operative said, speaking of journalists, I guess, said, "You in the reality-based community may think these things are important, but we're in the faith-based presidency, and we don't care about what you say about reality. We make the facts. We can create facts." And something like that seems to be going on, at least for portions of the Republican base. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with things we understand ourselves psychologically. People have to harmonize their opinions with their earlier opinions. Mm. So if you have a good opinion of Mr. Bush and you feel that the war was right, you've got to harmonize that somehow with the facts on the ground. And either you change the original opinion, or you take a darker opinion of Mr. Bush and the war, or you just deny the facts. And I think a lot of people in the Republican base who really believe in George Bush and who believed in this war are struggling with that. And some of them, I think, just say, well, the heck with these facts. That's in the newspaper. That's the liberal New York Times. That's NPR. I believe what I believe. But, you know, after a while, even the person striving to prevent cognitive dissonance, even after a while, that person has to recognize, it seems to me, where we are in Iraq. But it's very painful for people, I think, to combine the two, to take what they their earlier commitments and what they see on TV and to bring them together.
We're talking fear and fearlessness with Arianna Huffington. Mildred's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Mildred, you're on the air.
I'm 76 years old, and my first 15 years were spent in times that really should have been fearful, the Depression and the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But we had an adult who was a leader, and he led us, and that was FDR. We didn't really feel fear, and he kind of gathered us together and said, okay, this is what we do. And everybody had a job. I lived in Detroit, the Arsenal of Democracy, and I could see all the stuff, the tanks, the jeeps, the planes from Willow Run that were helping us to conquer this, not boogeyman, but a real guy. And, Bush is telling us, be afraid of this boogeyman, blah, 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 you know. And
And you're dreaming back to FDR in youth when there was a truly giant conflict going on, and you weren't
and
feeling.
And we did it in 4 years, 4.5 years from the time we got in.
Quicker than the war on terror. Mildred, thanks for that. Arianna, what would that kind of leadership sound like now? Do you hear anyone giving it in the Republican or Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, let me just say that Mildred raised a really important point, which is that fearlessness is not just a function of external circumstances. She talked about going through the Depression, going through some of the toughest times this country has seen, and not being afraid. In the same way, we can be going through economic insecurity in our personal lives or our collective lives and still go through it fearlessly. And that's really the point I'm making. And then that is translated into politics. And of course, we would all love to see an FDR emerge again. And no, Tom, I don't see him or her around yet, but it may happen. But in the meantime, what I'm trying to say in this book is that while we are waiting for the knight on the white charger to save us, we can actually act fearlessly in our own personal lives, and in the course of doing that, become more fearless as citizens and become more fearless as leaders, because the two things are connected. And that's what I believe is needed more than ever now. I even talk about creating kind of fearlessness tribes, people around us who are supporting us in our fearlessness, and we are supporting them in return, so that we can actually reinforce, especially at times of fear and war as we are living through now, those parts of ourselves that are fearless.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Tony. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to apologize for being a native of the state that gave the country both the Civil War and ensured the nomination of George W. Bush.
Don't apologize, my friend. We've all got history. What do you see today?
I think Ariana's right on about the fearlessness issue. The Republican Party are also hate mongers as well as fear mongers. I see that in so much of what is commonly called, I guess, the Republican base, the evangelical religious right. And I don't see any way to stop it, any way to fight it. It's a no-win proposition for the liberals. On the issue of terrorism, if nothing happens, then they're keeping us safe. If there's an attack, well, we told you so. And they're going to win on that. And they're going to play that card because it's the only card they've got left.
So, Tony, what's your question for Ariana?
Well, I did have a question for Ariana, so maybe a little off topic. I remember when she was a staunch conservative, and
yes.
I'm wondering where the tipping point came in her life that moved her from the right to the left. And I guess I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tony. Ariana?
Thank you, Tony. The tipping point had to do with my understanding of the role of government. It was sort of around 95, 96, when I began to see that what I thought would be private sector or efforts to deal with our social problems were not ever really going to materialize at a substantive enough level and of a great enough magnitude to make a difference, and that therefore we did need an activist government and the raw power of government appropriations to deal with all those social problems. And I was always a social moderate, so on issues like gay rights, gun control, choice, you know, I didn't have to change my mind. It was always so for me. But when it came to my understanding of the role of government, that's when the change happened. And again, to go back to allowing the facts on the ground to change our minds, I feel that's an incredibly important part of being alive and being honest. And yes, as I write in the book, I did lose friends. It's not easy to change publicly your political alliances, but the alternative was to continue to say things I no longer believed.
Tony says the left is in a no-win proposition here. And we want to hear from Republicans as well in this hour, but what about it? He says no-win proposition. You get attacked, fear. You don't get attacked, credit.
I don't agree with that. Absolutely not. I believe that this is an incredible opportunity for people who want to redefine what it is to make this country secure and who want to challenge the idea that staying in Iraq is at the center of that strategy, to actually come out and clearly and unambiguously say so. And all the facts are supporting that position, including the latest intelligence report about the fact that we've produced a lot more terrorists than we have destroyed.
President Bush talked about these issues on the five-year anniversary of September 11th. He spoke about the relationship between 9/11 and the war in Iraq.
I'm often asked why we're in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was not responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The answer is that the regime of Saddam Hussein was a clear threat. My administration, the Congress, and the United Nations saw the threat. And after 9/11, Saddam's regime posed a risk that the world could not afford to take.
The president suggesting that he was indeed fearless. What do you see? Jenna's calling from Bethesda, Maryland. Hi, Jenna. You're on the air.
Hi. I've often been mystified by the fact that the blame for 9/11 has been, it was never really clearly placed on George Bush. And of course, it wasn't entirely his fault, but it just seems that he got a complete pass on it. And then when Clinton was on Fox News and was really laying into him, like, you know, this was at least partially your fault. I can't believe that hasn't been the dialogue over the last 5 years. When they had the Republican convention in New York with the backdrop saying 9/11, you know, they just are perfectly fine with you know, using this horrible event as this thing that just happened like a hurricane, and they have no blame for themselves. And more than that, I'm really horrified by the idea that people are so partisan that they don't see past that, that they'll support him for whatever reason. He, you know, agrees with them ideologically about religion or something.
Jennifer, we've got the point, and let me take it to Ariana. Ariana, here you are, our famous Greek immigrant today. Greeks know a lot about mythology. Is there some greater success in the GOP into tapping into mythic archetypes that makes their version of the world, their version of the facts, somehow more effective politically than the Democrats these days?
Tom, you're now talking my language. I really believe that we need to approach what's happening in deeper ways in order to understand it. You're absolutely right about that. I think they're tapping into our lizard brain that is afraid, that moves into survival mode and bypasses rational thinking. That's why the things that are obvious to Jennifer are not obvious to many people, not the majority, but you don't need the majority right now. We see how the turnout in the elections is about half the people who are eligible to vote. So you need only the majority of them in order to get elected. That's why it is so, so important in order to counter what's happening to also move to a deeper place. That's why I'm talking about things that are not just policy matters, that are not just the latest polls, but how we respond to elections and how we respond to our leaders. And when we move to that place of clarity, which is where what fearlessness gives us, we will see the things that Jennifer is seeing. And all we need is a critical mass of people to get to that point. But we're never going to get everybody.
But what's the storyline, Ariana Huffington, that would take people to that point? If you're sitting at the Huffington Post in kind of Democratic camp shoes, George Bush has a storyline that's worked for him. What's the storyline, the kind of big mythological framing, if you will, that would put a different view in charge?
The storyline is our leaders and we were misled. We take responsibility for that. We engaged in an unnecessary and immoral war. It is now our time to change course and accepting full frontally that this is the right way to go right now. Change. Changing course is the right way. Not staying the course when we are going over the cliff by staying on this course. And recognizing that we have an opportunity still to isolate the extremists that you cannot reason with in the Islamic world from the rest of the Arab world instead of what we are having now, which is multiplying the converts to the cause of extremism and the cause of anti-Americanism. And, you know, this is not a complicated storyline. It just needs to be uttered unambiguously. That's really what is missing. If you want to talk about storylines, even the best storyline with all the facts on its side is not going to win without conviction. What is missing is conviction. What is missing is standing up and saying this without any doubt. There should be no doubt. The facts are unequivocal. But so many politicians on our side, on the Democratic side, are so doubtful. I mean, look at Hillary Clinton calling for Don Rumsfeld's resignation and in the same breath saying, because we need a new Secretary of Defense to complete the mission. What's the mission? If you accept that there is a mission to complete in Iraq, it's over. The guy with the other storyline has won.
Jack Beattie, do you hear the narrative of a Democratic success there, or George Bush still with the kind of narrative whip hand here?
I think the Republicans have the narrative whip hand. There are two kinds of politics. There's interest politics. How am I doing? What's the economy like? Am I going to go ahead and so on? And there's status politics or cultural politics. And that refers to the symbols, to anxieties people have about their place in the world and the country's place in the world. And the Republicans command that ground of cultural politics. And really what I think they do is they appeal to people's love of country. And that love for many Americans is uncritical. And that's been fed on, you know, years of self-praise that our leaders have gone in for and congratulations of the country. But I think that then the Democrats come along and they say, no, you spent 0.5% less last year than you did on the bill. And only if you'd increase the expenditure. In other words, they get into the swamp of details and facts and so on. And the Republicans say, take the big view. You know, are we strong? Are we righteous? Are we fighting against evil? And I think for a lot of Americans, that's the view they take. Cultural politics is a very, very powerful brew at a time when economic politics, economic interest politics, are not so clear. I mean, in a depression, cultural politics goes out the window and everybody worries about making a living. But in a time like this, when things are uncertain, I think cultural politics is in the saddle and the Republicans command those symbols.
Let's get another view from Columbia, South Carolina. Joseph is on the line. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hello. This is Dr. Joseph Fuller. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I would just like to say that I've read Arianna Huffington's writings, and I'm listening to her on the air, and I think she's a total nutcake and very naive, and thank God she does not represent the majority views of the Republicans of this country.
Naive in which respect, Joseph, sir?
I don't think she understands the enemy that we're against. I think that she thinks if we just leave Iraq and go away, everything's going to be fine, and we're going to go our merry way, and they're going to go their merry way. We didn't bomb them. They bombed our World Trade Center. And this set a whole new tone in this world, and we're in a different era right now, and there's a lot of people that do not understand it.
Joseph, stick with us for a second. Arianna, what do you say?
Well, Joseph, you just said something which is absolutely not true. They, meaning Iraq, did not bomb the World Trade Center, and that's the whole problem. They, i.e. Osama bin Laden, who did bomb the World Trade Center, are still somewhere and have not been caught, despite the president's promise to catch him dead or alive. And that's the problem. I have no illusion that if our troops come home, the war on terror will be over, not for a second, but at least we'll begin to focusing on our resources on fighting the real enemy, Afghanistan at the moment, where the real enemy is hiding or close there, is in disarray because we've taken our eye off Afghanistan and are focusing on Iraq. And a lot of other major crises in terms of our security are looming around the world, Iran, North Korea, but we don't have the resources or the attention to deal with them.
Joseph, does Arianna turn you at all?
Absolutely does not change my opinion one iota. Our eye is not off of Afghanistan and Iran or anywhere else such as North Korea. These people are just intent on bashing the country, bashing the president, and are causing aid and comfort to our enemies. Whether or not we should have gone into Iraq is the moot point at this time. We are there, and we've got to finish this job. Now, it is a fact, and I would agree, that the Iraqis and most of those people, if I can use it in that pronoun context, do not understand democracy. We didn't either as a country when we first started, and we're not perfect. But we've got to finish this job, and we've got to protect our citizens and support this president instead of spending our time bashing it and tearing the country apart.
Joseph, we hear it. Shoulder to shoulder with the president, and thank you for your call. Let's get one from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Bashar is calling. Hi, Bashar. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hello. I just want to talk about the fact that we are so poorly educated here in our schools, and that poor education allows us to have fear of the unknown, or actually it feeds that fear of the unknown. The lack of education in history or culture about other countries around the world, especially the Middle East and Islam and so on, allows people or people allow them to take their facts or twisted facts that's filtered through the media that politicians are feeding. And as a matter of fact, it turns it into a way of kind of establishing fear in people because they have no education about these areas of the world. And that's my point, and I'll take the comments of the air.
Bashar, thanks for calling. Arianna, can we educate our way out of this? I mean, Joseph says, look, we're in a fight, and let's face it and stick with the leader we've got. Bashar says, suggests if we learn something more, there might be a different way out or a better way out.
Well, definitely educating ourselves about the enemy as well as about the area where we are so embroiled at the moment is incredibly important. Remember, the president barely knew Sunnis from Shiites before we went into Iraq, and then we see how tragic that lack of knowledge was.
Let's get a call from Nashville. Andy's on the line. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
How are you?
We're good. What do you see out there, Andy?
Well, I take Joseph's tack that it seems like Arianna says that people are fearless when they agree with her side of the the political debate, and then if they disagree, that they're, you know, playing to people's, you know, fears and fear-mongering and war-mongering. You know, when she brings up FDR, I've read books on his administration. He actually thought we should have been involved with World War II way before Pearl Harbor, but the American public wasn't up, you know, up to his way of thinking, and rather than taking a leadership, fearless role, he basically, you know, just sat back on his haunches. And, of course, he did, you know, aid Russia and some of our allies with the land lease program, but as far as getting actively involved, which is where he thought we should have been, he didn't lead. He was fearful. I think George Bush recognized the problem and the threat, and it really is not important that they had anything to do with 9/11. It's more of a general terrorist threat. Look, we went to the Gulf War because Saddam Hussein, and we did have a coalition there. I mean, I don't think anybody can dispute.
Yeah, it's a big one then, right?
Right, and it was there was a ceasefire. The war was not ended. There were certain things that he had to do, like the no-fly zone. There were several things that he had to let inspectors in.
Our time grows short, but we hear it. You see fearlessness in wading back into this, Ariana. How about it? You know there's the view that this is fearlessness, unacceptance of a reality of terrorism, saying we're going to reshape the world in a way that's more in line with our ideals.
Well, first of all, let me just say that I think what Jack said about symbolic politics being what's driving our politics right now is incredibly important, because there's no way that the last couple of callers and I can have a rational conversation, because they do not want to look at the facts. So let us talk at the level of symbols. And that's why I'm urging people to operate at that level of symbols, to come from a greater internal place of fearlessness, which may seem not to have immediately a lot to do with the 06 election or current politics. But trust me, it does. Because from that place there is clarity, from that place there is conviction, and from that place we are willing to take risks and speak out, even when we are going to be immediately identified as bashing the country or all those RNC talking points that we see repeated again and again and again, because they play into the symbolic politics. So that's why, you know, I really want to urge your listeners to go to fearlessvoices.com that we've started as part of the Huffington Post and participate in that debate there, because we'll see in that collective understanding, in those stories that are appearing in fearlessvoices.com, how people can really reinforce for each other and that contagious fearlessness, which will have an immediate impact on our political system.
You're a very prominent woman in this debate, and in the book on becoming fearless, you spend a lot of focus on women, not just at this big public level, but also fearlessness in love and parenting, in work and money. What about the role of women here? Why do you focus on women in particular when you've got an agenda that clearly goes across the whole country?
I have a tremendous hope that women will be in the forefront of this epidemic of fearlessness. We've held ourselves back. We've obviously been held back by culture, but we've also held ourselves back because of our fears, our preoccupation with how we're looking, our fear of speaking out, but also what I call in the book the obnoxious roommate inside our head that keeps putting us down, that keeps undermining us. So if we can actually deal with those inner voices of doubt and see how much we can do by identifying and finding what I call the leader in the mirror, finding our own leadership potential in our own families, in our own communities. I think we have an enormous role to play participating in our democracy, especially at this time, which is fraught with so many dangers if we don't act differently.
Jack Beattie, there it is, a woman calling on all citizens and on women in particular, be fearless. Do you hear a tune of change there, Jack?
It's so hard to do. It's an aristocratic virtue. You have to be able to afford fearlessness. But I'm with you, Ariana, when you say live with the conflict. Understand that fear is part of life, and to deny it on the one hand, or to be ruled by it on the other, neither makes sense. But on the other hand, we have to wrestle with our fears, and often just to keep us alive, they have to get the better hand.
There we go. Arianna Huffington, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for the new book, On Becoming Fearless, Love, Work, and Life, and the Huffington Post work. Thanks for being with us this hour. Terrific to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Jack.
Jack Beatty, great to have you as well. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.